Schroeder stepped onto the bottom rung of the ladder and began to climb. 50 feet up, he reached a narrow embrasure cut back into the wall. It was just wide enough to squeeze his shoulders through. Another priest waited for him in the tiny stone cell beyond. One after the other, Schroeder's men followed him up and slid over the lintel until all of them were crowded into the room.
"Lead us to the infant first," Schroeder ordered the priest, and placed his hand on his bony shoulder.
His men followed along the dark, winding passageways, each gripping the shoulder of the man in front. They twisted and turned through the dark labyrinth, until at last they descended a spiral staircase and saw a glimmer of light ahead. It grew stronger as they crept towards it, until they reached a doorway, on either side of which torches guttered in their brackets. Two guards lay huddled on the threshold with their weapons laid beside them.
"Kill them," Schroeder whispered to Ezekiel.
"They are dead already," said the priest.
Schroeder touched one with his foot. The guard's arm flopped over lifelessly, and the empty bowl that had held the poisoned mead rolled from his hand.
The priest tapped a signal on the door, and the locking bar was lifted on the far side.
The door swung open, and a nursemaid stood on the other side with a child in her arms, her eyes huge with terror in the light of the torches.
"Is this the one?"
Schroeder lifted the folded blanket and peered into the child's sweet brown face. His eyes were closed in sleep, and the dark curls were damp with perspiration.
"This is the one," the priest confirmed.
Schroeder took a firm grip on the nursemaid's arm and drew her out beside him.
"Now lead me to the other thing," he said softly.
They went on deeper into the maze of dark halls and narrow corridors, until they reached another heavy, studded door, before which lay the bodies of four priests, contorted in the agony of their poisoned deaths. The guide knelt beside one and groped in his robes. When he stood again, he had in his hands a massive iron key. He fitted it to the lock and stood back. Schroeder called Ezekiel to him in a whisper, and placed the nursemaid in his hands.
"Guard her well."
Then he stepped up to the door and seized the bronze handle. As it swung open, the traitorous priest and even the band of raiders shrank back from the brilliance of the light that flooded out from the stone-walled crypt. After the darkness, the glow of 100 candles was dazzling. Schroeder stepped over the threshold. Then even he faltered and came to an uncertain halt. He gazed upon the tabernacle in its suit of radiant tapestry. The angels upon the lid seemed to dance in the wavering light, and he was struck with a sense of religious awe. Instinctively, he crossed himself. He tried to step forward to lay hold of one of the handles of the chest, but it was as though he had encountered an invisible barrier that held him back. His breathing was hoarse, and his chest felt constricted. He was filled with an irrational urge to turn and run, and he recoiled a pace before he could check himself. Slowly, he backed out of the crypt.
"Ezekiel," he said hoarsely, "I will take care of the woman and the child. With Mustafa to help you, do you take hold of the chest?"
The two Muslims suffered from no religious qualms. They stepped forward eagerly and seized the handles. The tabernacle was surprisingly light, almost weightless. They bore it effortlessly between them.
"Our horses will be waiting at the main gate," Schroeder told their guide in Arabic. "Take us there."
They moved swiftly through the dark passages. Once they ran unexpectedly into another white-robed priest who was shuffling around an angle in the corridor towards them. In the uncertain light of the torches, he saw the tabernacle in the hands of the two armed soldiers, screamed with horror at the sacrilege, and fell to his knees. Schroeder had the woman's arm in his left hand and the naked Neptune sword in his right. He killed the kneeling priest with a single thrust through his ribs. They all listened quietly for a while, but there was no outcry.
"Lead on," Schroeder ordered.
Their guide stopped again suddenly.
"The gate is only a short distance ahead. There are 3 men in the guardroom beside it."
Schroeder could make out the glow of their lamp falling through the open doorway.
"I must leave you here."
"Go with God," said Schroeder ironically, and the man darted away.
"Ezekiel, lay down the chest. Go forward and deal with the guards." 3 of them crept down the passage.
while Schroeder kept the nursemaid in his grasp. Ezekiel slipped into the guardroom. There was silence for a moment, and then the clatter of something falling to the stone floor. Schroeder winced, but all was quiet again, and Ezekiel came back.
"It is done."
"You grow old and clumsy," Schroeder chided him, and led them to the massive door. It took three of them to lift the great wooden beams that locked it. Then Ezekiel wound the handle of the primitive winch wheel, and the door trundled open.
"Keep close together now," Schroeder warned,
and led them in a running group across the bridge and out onto the rocky track. He paused in the moonlight and whistled once softly. There was the soft thudding of muffled hoofs, and the horse holders left the rocks where they had been concealed. Ezekiel lifted the tabernacle onto the pack saddle of the spare horse and lashed it securely in place. Then each man seized the reins of his own mount and swung up into the saddle. Schroeder reached down and lifted the sleeping child out of the arms of his nursemaid. The boy squawked drowsily, but Schroeder hushed him and settled him firmly on the pommel of his saddle.
"Go," he ordered the nursemaid. "You are no longer needed." "I cannot leave my baby," the woman's voice was high and agitated.
Schroeder leaned down again and with a thrust of the Neptune sword killed the nursemaid cleanly. He left her lying beside the track and led the raiding party away down the mountainside.
"Two of the priests from the monastery were able to follow the blasphemers when they fled," Judith Nazareth explained to Hal.
Even in the face of disaster, her lips was firm and her eyes calm and steady. He admired her fortitude and saw how she had been able to take command of a broken army and turn it victorious.
"Where are they now?"
Hal demanded. He was so shaken by the dreadful news that it was difficult to think clearly and logically.
"They rode directly from the monastery to Tenwera. They reached there just before dawn 3 hours ago, and there was a great ship waiting for them, anchored in the bay."
"Did they describe this vessel to you?" Hal demanded.
"Yes, it was the privateer that has the commission of the Mogul. The one we spoke of before, at our last meeting. The same one that has caused such havoc amongst our fleet of transports."
"The Buzzard," Hal exclaimed.
"Yes, that is what he is called even by his allies," Judith nodded. "While my people watched from the cliffs, a small boat took both the Emperor and the Tabernacle out to where this ship was anchored. As soon as they were aboard, the Buzzard weighed anchor and set out to sea."
"Which direction?"
"When he was out of the bay, he turned south."
"Yes, of course," Hal nodded. "He would have been ordered to take Iyasu and the Tabernacle to Muscat, or even to India, to the realm of the Great Mogul."
"I have already sent one of our fastest ships to follow him. It was only an hour or so behind him, and the wind is light. It is a small dhow and could never attack such a powerful ship as his. But if God is merciful, it should still be shadowing him."
"We must follow at once." He turned away and called urgently to Ned Tyler.
"Bring her around and lay her on the opposite tack. Set all sail, every yard of canvas you can cram onto her. Course is south-southeast for the Bab el Mandeb."
He took Judith's arm, first time he'd ever touched her, and led her down to his cabin.
"You are weary," he said. "I can see it in your eyes."
"No, Captain," she replied.
"It is not weariness you see, but sorrow. If you cannot save us, then all is lost. A king, a country, a faith."
"Please sit," he insisted. "I will show you what we must do." He opened the chart in front of her. The Buzzard might sail straight across to the western coast of Arabia. If he does that, then we have lost. Even in this ship, I cannot hope to catch him before he reaches the other shore. The early morning sun shone in through the stern windows and cruelly showed up the marks of anguish chiselled into her lovely face. It was a terrible thing for Hal to see the pain his words had caused, and he looked down at the chart to spare her. "However, I do not believe that that is what he will do. If he sails directly to Arabia, the Emperor and the Tabernacle would have a dangerous and difficult overland journey to reach either Muscat or India." He shook his head.
"No, he will sail south through the Bab el Mandeb."
Hal placed his finger on the narrow entrance to the Red Sea. "If we can reach there before he does, then he cannot avoid us. The Bab is too narrow. We must be able to catch him there."
"God grant it," Judith prayed.
"I have a long account to settle with the Buzzard," Hal said grimly. "I ache in every part of my body and soul to have him under my guns." Judith looked up at him in consternation. "You cannot fire upon his ship."
"What do you mean?"
He stared back at her.
"He has the Emperor and the Tabernacle on board with him. You cannot risk destroying either of those."
As he realized the truth of what she had said, Hal felt his spirits quail. He would have to run down the Gull of Murray and close with her while the Buzzard fired his broadsides into the Golden Bough, and he could make no reply. He could imagine the terrible punishment they would have to endure, the cannonballs ripping through the hull of his ship, and the slaughter on her decks before they could board the Gull. The Golden Bough ran on into the south.
At the end of the forenoon watch, Hal assembled all the men in the waist of the ship and told them of the task he demanded of them.
"I will not hide it from you, lads. The Buzzard will be able to have his way with us, and we will not be able to fire back."
They were silent and sober-faced.
"But think how sweet it will be when we go aboard the Gull and take the steel to them."
They cheered him then, but there was fear in their eyes when he sent them back to trim the sails and coax every inch of speed out of the ship in her flight towards the Bab el Mandeb.
"You promise them death and they cheer you?" Judith Nazet said softly when they were alone. "Yet you call me a leader of men?"
He thought he heard more than respect in her tone.
Halfway through the first dog watch, there was a hail from the masthead.
"Sail ho! Foot on the bow!"
Hal's pulse raced.
Could they have caught the Buzzard so soon?
He snatched the speaking trumpet from its bracket.
"Masthead, what do you make of her?"
"Latine rig."
His heart sank.
"A small ship on the same course as we are."
Judith said quietly, "It could be the one I sent to follow the Gull." Gradually they gained on the other vessel, and within half an hour it was hull up from the deck. Hal handed his telescope to Judith, and she studied it carefully.
"Yes, it is my scout." She lowered the glass. "Can you fly the White Cross to allay their fears? Then take me close enough to speak to her?"
They passed her so closely that they could look down onto her single deck. Judith shouted a question in Guise, then listened to the faint reply. She turned back to Hal, her eyes bright with excitement.
"You were right. They have been following the Gull since dawn. Until only a few hours ago they had her topsails in sight, but then the wind strengthened and she pulled away from them."
"What course was she on when last they saw her?"
"The same course she has held all this day," Judith told him. "Due south, heading straight for the narrows of the Bab."
Though he entreated her to go down to his cabin and rest, Judith insisted on staying beside him on the quarterdeck. They spoke little, for both were too tense and fearful. But slowly there came over them a feeling of companionship. They took comfort from each other, and drew on a mutual reserve of strength and determination. Every few minutes Hal looked up at his funereal black sails, then crossed to the binnacle. There was no order he could give the helm, for Ned Tyler was steering her fine as she could sail. A charged and poignant silence lay heavy on the ship. No man shouted or laughed. The off-duty watch did not doze in the shade of the mainsail, as was their usual practice, but huddled in small silent groups, alert to every move he made and to every word he uttered. The sun made its majestic circle of the sky and drooped down to touch the far western hills. Night came upon them as stealthily as an assassin, and the horizon blurred and melded with the darkening sky, then was gone. In the darkness he felt Judith's hand on his arm. It was smooth and warm, yet strong.
"We have lost them. But it is not your fault," she said softly. "No man could have done more."
"I have not failed yet," he said. "Have faith in God and trust in me."
"But in darkness? Surely the Buzzard would not show a light.
and by dawn tomorrow he will be through the bub and into the open sea. He wanted to tell her that all of this had been ordained long ago, that he was sailing south to meet a special destiny. Even though this might seem fanciful to her, he had to tell her. "Judith," he said, then paused as he sought the right words. "Deck!" Abilene's voice boomed out of the darkness high above. It had a timbre and a resonance to it that made Hal's skin prickle and the hairs at the back of his neck stand. "Masthead!" he bellowed back. "A light dead ahead!" He placed one arm around Judith's shoulders, and she made no move to pull away from him. Instead, she leaned closer. "There is the answer to your question," he whispered. "God has provided for us," she replied. "I must go aloft." Hal dropped his arm from around her shoulders. "Perhaps we are too hasty and the devil is playing us tricks." He strode across to Ned. "Dark ship, Mr. Tyler. I'll keelhaul the man who shows a light. Silent ship, no sound or voice." He went to the mainmast shrouds. Hal climbed swiftly until he had joined Abberley. "Where is this light?" He scanned the darkness ahead. "I see nothing." "It has gone. But it was almost dead ahead."
"A star in your eye, Abberley?"
"Wait, Gundwani. It was a small light and far away."
The minutes passed slowly, and then suddenly Hal saw it. Not even a glimmer, but a soft luminescence, so nebulous that he doubted his eyes, especially as Abberley beside him had shown no sign of seeing it. Hal looked away to rest his eyes, then turned back and saw in the darkness that it was still there, too low for a star, a weird, unnatural glow.
"Yes, Abberley, I see it now."
As he spoke, it became brighter, and Abberley exclaimed also. Then it died away again.
"It could be a strange vessel, not the Gull. Surely the Buzzard would not be so careless as to show a running light."
"A lantern in the stern cabin? The reflection from his binnacle?
Or one of the sailors enjoying a quiet pipe? Let us pray that it is one of those. It is where we could expect the Buzzard to be," said Hal. "We will keep after it until moonrise."
They stayed together, peering ahead into the night. Sometimes the strange light showed as a distinct point. At others, it was a faint, amorphous glow, and often it disappeared. Once it was gone completely for a terrifying half hour before it shone again perceptibly stronger.
"We are gaining," Hal dared whisper.
"How far off now, do you reckon?"
"A league," said Abberley. "Maybe less."
"Where is the moon?" Hal looked into the east. "Will it never rise?"
He saw the first iridescence beyond the dark mountains of Arabia, and shyly as a bride the moon unveiled her face. She laid down a silver path upon the waters, and Hal felt his breath lock in his chest and every sinew of his body drawn tight as a bowstring. Out of the darkness ahead appeared a lovely apparition, soft as a cloud of opaline mist.
"There she is," he whispered.
He had to draw a deep breath to steady his voice.
"The Gull of Murray is dead ahead."
He grasped Abberley's arm.
"Do you go down and warn Ned Tyler and Big Daniel. Stay there until you can see the Gull from the deck, then come back."
When Abberley was gone, he watched the shape of the Gull's sails, firm and hardened in the moonlight, and he felt fear as he had seldom known it in his life. Fear not only for himself, but for the men who trusted him, and the woman on the deck below, and the child aboard the other ship. How could he hope to lay the golden bow alongside the Gull, while she fired her broadsides into them? And they could make no reply. How many must die in the next hour, and who would be among them? He thought of Judith Nazet's proud, slim body torn by flying grape.
"Do not let it happen, Lord God. You have taken from me already more than I can bear. How much more? How much more will you ask of me?"
He saw the light again on board the other ship. It glowed from the tall windows in her stern.
Were there candles burning in there?
He stared until his eyes ached, but there was no single source to the emanation of light. There was a light touch on his arm.
He had not heard Aberley climb back to him.
"The gull is in sight from the deck," he told Hal softly.
Hal could not leave the masthead yet, for he felt a sense of religious dread as he stared at the strange light in the gull's stern.
"'Tis no lamp or lantern or candle, Aberley," he said. "'Tis the tabernacle of Mary that glows in the darkness, a beacon to guide me to my destiny."
Aberley shivered beside him.
"'Tis true that it is not a light from this world, a fairy light, such as I have never seen before."
His voice shook.
"But how do you know, Gundwani? How can you be so sure that it is the talisman that burns so?"
"Because I know," said Hal simply. And as he said it, the light died away before their eyes, and the gull was dark. Only her moonlit sails towered before them.
"It was a sign,"
Aberley murmured. "Yes, it was a sign," said Hal, and his voice was strong and serene once again. "God has given me a sign." They climbed down to the deck, and Hal went directly to the helm.
"There she is, Mr. Tyler."
They both looked ahead to where the gull's canvas shone in the moonlight.
"Aye, there she is, Cap'n.
Douse the light in the binnacle. Lay me alongside the gull, if you please. Have four spare helmsmen standing by to take the whipstaff when the others are killed."
"Aye, Sir Hal."
Hal went forward. Big Daniel's figure emerged out of the darkness. "Grappling irons, Master Daniel?"
"All ready, Cap'n. Me and 10 of my strongest men will heave them."
"Nay, Daniel, leave that to John Lovell. I have better work for you and Aberley. Come with me." He led Daniel and Aberley back to where Judith Nazet stood at the foot of the mainmast.
"The two of you will go with General Nazet. Take 10 of your best seamen. Do not get caught up in the fighting on deck. Swift as you can, get down to the gull's stern cabin. There you will find the tabernacle and the child. Bring them out. Nothing must turn you aside from that purpose. Do you understand?"
"How do you know where they are holding the Emperor and the tabernacle?" Judith Nazet asked quietly.
"I know," Hal said, with such finality that she was silent.
He wanted to order her to stay in a safe place until the fight was over, but he knew she'd refuse, and besides which there was no safe place when two ships of such force were locked in mortal combat.
"Where will you be, Gundwani?" Aberley asked softly.
"I shall be with the Buzzard," Hal said, and left them without another word.
He went towards the bows, pausing as he reached each of the divisions who crouched below the gunwale, and speaking softly to their bosuns.
"God love you, Samuel Moon. We might have to take a shot or two before we board her, but think of the pleasure that waits you on the gull's deck." To Jiri he said, "This will be such a fight as you will boast of to your grandchildren."
He had a word for each, then stood once more in the bows and looked across at the gull. She was a cable's length ahead now, sailing on serenely under her moon-radiant canvas.
"Lord, keep us hidden from them," he whispered, and looked up at his own black sails, a tall dark pyramid against the stars.
Slowly, achingly slowly, they closed the gap.
"She cannot elude us now," Hal thought with grim satisfaction. "We are too close."